Hey, what's up? This is Mike Fenoya, host of Amigos Podcast here on the Osiris Network. What is Amigos Podcast? Well, I am a stand-up comedian, writer for True TV's Impractical Jokers, and a music freak. So I invite my pals to come talk music, comedy, and everything in between. So if you want to come hang, we'd love to have you. Thank you.
I'm Bob Crawford, and this is The Road to Now. Ben Sawyer is on assignment. I bet you do this once a day. I pretty much do. You get home, you go to the pantry, you get a loaf of bread. You open up the plastic wrapper it traveled in, get a couple slices out, go back to the refrigerator, and you get some turkey slices, maybe some ham slices that you had sliced at the local grocery store, deli counter. Go back to the refrigerator, get a jar of mustard, probably a plastic jar. Maybe you want some pickles on your sandwich. I know I like pickles on my sandwich. They're normally in a glass jar. And you make a sandwich and you eat it. But do you really know where your food came from? Do you really understand how it was packaged? How it was produced in the first place? Well, this week on The Road to Now, we speak with Ben Cohen. He's an associate professor at Lafayette College. He's the author of Pure Adulteration, Cheating on Nature in the Age of Manufactured Food. Really great book. Fascinating. This is the stuff I love talking about. I love learning about. How did it come to be that our food was packaged the way it is, manufactured the way it is? And once the distance our food traveled to get to us got to be further than our own town or the next town over, how could we prove that it was safe? How did we know it was safe? How could we trust that? Well, you're going to learn that that opened up a whole new avenue of science and research to verify what was claimed to be in food actually was in the food. So I think you're really going to enjoy this episode. Ben and I are still so excited about our last two Road to Now Lives from a couple weekends ago. We were in Charlotte, North Carolina, and then we were at the Cat's Cradle in Carrboro. Well, I want to remind you, we have two live Road to Nows coming up soon. Tickets are available for both of these shows. We have April 18th in Nashville, Tennessee, as part of the Nashville Comedy Festival. It's at TPAC's Polk Theater. Director Tom Shadyac's on the bill, as is musician Langhorne Slim. Very excited for that show. 4 to 6 p.m. Saturday, April 18th, Nashville, Tennessee. And then on Tuesday, June 16th, from 8 to 10 p.m. at the Pantages Theater in Minneapolis, Minnesota, we're doing a show that's part of the Minneapolis Comedy Festival. So guests will be announced for that soon. Tickets for both shows are on sale now. We hope to see you there.
Ben Cohen, welcome to The Road to Now.
Thank you very much.
This is one of those fantastic situations where we get an email from a scholar who says, hey, I wrote a new book. Would you be interested in checking it out and maybe having me on the podcast? And he sent us the book, and I was like, we would absolutely love to have you on the podcast. Because your book, Pure Adulteration, Cheating on Nature in the Age of Manufactured Food, recently came out. This book is so thoughtful, and it really gets at the questions of, I think, that we're struggling with right now. What is natural? What is real? Like, what can we anchor ourselves to? All these things that for so long were something that we thought were eternal, they're shifting. So the first chapter of your book opens with this really interesting story about adulteration of food and the consequences. And it's a pretty remarkable story because it captures the moment, but it's also kind of funny. Could you tell us the story about the adulterer?
Yeah, the book starts in 1879 at a trial in Santiago, Chile. And this guy, Alfred Paroff, is on trial. He's not a dude that I don't think anybody remembers anymore, but at the time he was known as the King of Swindlers. He was a con man who was from France. He was a chemist, And he had globetrotted from France to North America, East Coast to West Coast to South America. And people were on his trail for years. He swindled people left and right, even his own family back home, even the governor of Rhode Island twice, almost the governor of California. He met with Leland Stanford, but Stanford didn't take the bait. This guy, here's some quotes. They called him foremost in the ranks of the world's swindlers. They said he had the black heart of a conscienceless scoundrel. They described his, like, how dapper and he had large, eloquent eyes. He had a wax tip mustache. I have a picture of him in the book. And I love this phrase too. He had the suave address of a gentleman. I don't think I've ever heard that, but like the suave address of a gentleman. He had the form and features of an Apollo to match the polished manners of a citizen of the world. One of the Brooklyn Daily Papers, and here's a quote of them saying that Paroff, P-A-R-A-F, Paroff stood above and beyond his fellows who, compared with him, were mere bunglers in operations, which he had reduced to an exact science and of which he was the greatest exponent. So here's this guy in trial, on trial.
Wait, well, I'm going to say this. Certainly he must be on trial for like stealing state secrets or for like being a double agent with espionage, something like that, right?
It was pretty bad. I mean, you're close. You're getting close.
Okay.
The final line is that they call him handsome, refined, clever, brilliant, extravagant, immoral, and audacious. And do you want me to do the reveal? Do you remember what he was on trial for? I can tell you.
How could I forget?
This guy was running the margarine con. This was all for fake butter. So his story laces through the opening chapter because it tells and touches on so many of the themes that seem somewhat absurd. It's always been amusing to me that level of description of the vile nature of this guy applied to a guy who was selling margarine, which was a relatively new invention at the time. But the fact that he was a con man is key here because deception, trust, trickery, and the false front of new foods. Like, are these fake foods just as fake as this fake guy? So he was like doing a double thing where he was fake and the thing he was selling was fake.
And the crime was he was selling margarine as butter. And this was an offense to people because there was something unnatural about that in their eyes, huh?
Yeah, it was if they didn't use the term natural, they at least thought this is offensive to them because it's not right or it's not normal or you're trying to trick me. You're another con man who's trying to sell me snake oil.
And the great irony is, what is the best known margarine brand on the market? I can't believe it's not butter. Right.
So that like for me, that's like give it another 100 years and now we're bragging about the deception. Like this total shift historically where it's people are proud to say that I can trick you. You can't believe it's not butter.
Yeah. It didn't win that on trial though, huh? Like, Your Honor, can you believe this is not butter? Well, yes, I can.
You know, for us, we think of natural versus artificial, but at this time it was all about adulteration, the term adulteration.
Yeah. So it was either pure or adulterated. Adulteration, like contaminated, corrupted. Today we would say it might come up more of like a person of, I didn't mean this as a topical reference, but someone of unimpeachable character, someone who's unadulterated, completely honest and on the up and up, or a product or something which is completely unadulterated. You know, it's totally pure. That was a very dominant language at the time. They would call it, in some circles, they call it the era of adulteration. The term isn't as common now, but that was the access point of is it pure or is it adulterated? And that begot served as a kind of proxy for an argument over natural and artificial. So if they weren't arguing directly about those big words, getting a little more esoteric about it or philosophical, practically they were arguing about it because it was either pure or adulterated.
You know, but this was the age of analysis, right? This was like this new age of scientific expertise. You talk about, you know, I guess the USDA had been around, but this helps to spawn the FDA. And you talk about all these new professions and careers that spring up here in the late 19th century. public analyst, analytical chemist, food scientists, public health officers. This was all new. This was all, like, today we think about, you know, real versus fake, and there's, we are skeptical of the experts, right? Like, that's what's happening now. We're calling into question all the experts, but 150 years ago, it was a matter of, we've got these experts now. We've got people that are incorruptible that can point out a fraud.
Yeah, that's part of the answer. Like, how do they address this? What I talk about by the end of the book is, like, I'm not really convinced that we've solved adulteration or contamination. It still happens. It's just in other forms or in different places. So I didn't take that as the consequence. But one thing that does change is you have this rise of new scientific technical experts who are anointed with the power to determine which of these is pure and which of these is adulterated. And they're getting below the surface. They can use microscopes, they can use chemical tests to find out the real answer, because we can't tell just from looking anymore. Our visual ability to see a product and know that it's what it claims to be is undermined with all these new manufactured products. And you need these analysts to kind of get under the surface.
And this is I think what's amazing about this, it's like caught up at this, in this period in the United States in particular, where it's the era of urbanization, the era where American culture is becoming more and more divorced from the actual productive work of farming. You've got the introduction of the reaper and all of these other technologies. Whereas for most of human history, you knew the people that made the thing that you were buying. Now you're going into cities where you've just got to trust whoever grew it. And this is where, I mean, originally this is the concept of, like, branding, right? So you create a brand so that you can vet something, but then you can just counterfeit the brand. So how do they grapple with this?
Part of it is, you know, it is the rise of modern advertising as we think of it. And modern advertising is a way, you know, trademarks and brands and imagery to mark your product. So it has some claim. But also you try to back this up with certification. There's like it's not just the brand, but it's the label. So they didn't have the same sophisticated labels that we have now on food. But, you know, I got into this project because earlier I had studied agricultural chemistry. And one of the first things that gets an analytical label is fertilizer, so that when farmers were going to get fertilizer, it was what they claimed it was. You know, like NPK or 12-12-12, you can still see it at the stores today. So it's not just having the brand, but it's building this analytical arsenal to say, you have quantified evidence that says right here on the outside that what's inside is what we claim it is. And so that scientific part is real central to all of it.
As you enter an era where chemistry creates new food products, where you have new formulas for things, you're no longer buying what we would call, like, whole food now. At this point, you're buying things that are mixtures or come in packaging. The problem becomes immediate that you don't know what's in there. And certainly the companies that are making these things, I mean, I tell my students, it's like, do you think that Mountain Dew wants to tell you all the things that are in it? Like, they don't want to tell you. They would prefer not to tell you those things, but it's regulation that eventually requires that they include those things on the side. And that was a fight, right?
Yeah, that was a big fight. There was, I don't know when this will air, but there's very recently an episode of PBS American Experience called The Poison Squad. It came out just a couple weeks ago. And this is based on a book by author Deborah Blum, which is it goes along well with my book. It talks about this guy, Harvey Wiley, who comes up in my book quite often. He's the head USDA chemist. So there's a Bureau of Chemistry in the USDA, and he's one of the central figures who's kind of on the hunt to stamp out and identify adulteration. So the production or the creation of regulation is the result of decades and decades of attempts to come up with food laws or food policing, you know, food policy. Like, how do we police food? We finally get the big one, the 1906 Pure Food and Drug Act. That's the law that, if people know it, it's because, you know, Upton Sinclair's The Jungle came out in 1906. That's usually the first thing that happens if you bring up that topic. But that law eventually spins into the FDA within a couple decades, but it grows out of the USDA. That law was the 192nd attempt at passing a law. From 1879 to 1906, they had tried 191 times in Congress to pass some form of a pure food law. So this eventual triumph wasn't really just because of Hampton Sinclair. It was like on the back of a lot of people who've been working for a long time to try to win this fight.
There is another con in your book besides margarine. It's corn syrup. Can you take us through the adulteration of corn and corn syrup? And yes, I think this is very relative to today and the things that we eat.
Yeah, it's in its initial era, they had this term glucose, which we know as blood sugar. You know, it's just a chemical term, glucose. But in the 1860s and 1870s, glucose was the term that they used for corn-derived sugars. So you could get sugar out of almost any plant. The two main ones were cane sugar from the cane fields of the tropics or beet sugar from beets. The Europeans were making a lot of beet sugar, and that's where they got their sweetener, or they were bringing it in from slave-based systems in the tropics from cane sugar. This new upstart was making sugar from corn, and it ran into the same kind of trouble that margarine did when people found out about it. It was less known at the time. It's less known now than margarine. Margarine was the big one, but it too suffered under the same confusion of, is this really what you tell me it is? And am I going to get sick if I eat this? So people are either worried, like, you're screwing me over because you're charging me something for a product and it's not really that. So you're a consumer and you're mad. Or they're mad because you're selling me this thing and it's going to make me sick and die. Like, have you tested this? Is this poison? Like, we don't really know. Either way, they don't trust the makers. There are a couple of con men, and sugar historians have done even more work on this of, God, it's just crazy, the world of sugar. And I only barely touched on it with like corn sugar. Corn syrup. But one con man is this guy, Professor Henry Friend, who wasn't a professor. and he wasn't selling something called electric sugar. So he had two things going on. One is he starts off in Chicago in the early 1880s, and that's where a lot of the glucose manufacturers were. They were pulling in the corn from the Midwest into Chicago, so it makes sense that he would be there. It's a little murky like what he did there, but he kind of got ran out of town for trying to run the glucose game. He ends up a few years later in Brooklyn, and he has this second thing. The second one is in a corn syrup-based one, but it's a scam that leads people to say, like, this whole world of like alternative sugars is the whole thing fake. He has this thing. I don't know. Maybe this could be one of your bands in the future. I think Electric Sugar Refinery Company. It's just a great band name.
That is a great band name.
Yeah. So he had the Electric Sugar Refinery Company, and it's now kind of a classic thing where he told people they had this secret patented process to electrify sugar to refine it into a higher grade. So if you gave him low-grade, dirty sugar, you put it into a secret process, he could create a high-grade, pure quality sugar. So it's from, like, rough and dirty, adulterated into pure fine grain. It sounds like drugs. Like, this all sounds like some kind of drug deal. A lot of these things sound like drugs.
It's like you put it in a Mountain Dew bottle and you shake it up for, like, 20 minutes, but not too much or it'll explode.
It's almost as if sugar is a drug.
Yeah. It is kind of understood and policed and... When you think of, I mean, I just said it in passing before, but like even cane sugar and the brutality of, former slave-based labor regimes in the South and in the tropics in South America, acquiring sugar has never been like a good thing. Just like the drug trade, like making and trafficking in drugs has never been a good thing. So those aren't separate. Like, yeah, sugar is just like a drug. So this guy... You got to think, it's the 1880s. It's like the heyday, early heyday of Thomas Edison. So anything electric is great. He's like, hey, this sugar is an electric process, just like Edison. He would bring in investors, and they would kind of go see the facility. It was in current-day Red Hook in Brooklyn. They kind of retrofitted this big seven-story tall building, and he would have a cover over the machine. He's like, well, you can't see under this thing because, you know, it's proprietary. This is my secret process. And then they would take them out of the room, and he would do this like presto change of fancy thing, and they come back in the room, and he'd you know, pull the hood off. And he's like, look at this pure sugar. Like, you gave me dirty and now it's pure. And if you've seen the documentary on Theranos, which is a current kind of scam about this blood testing machine out in Silicon Valley, they did the same thing. This was an HBO documentary a couple of years ago, maybe last year, where they kind of cover the machine and tell you, put in your blood sample and it's going to spit out the answer, but we can't tell you what's inside the machine. And it sounds like there really wasn't anything inside the machine. Same thing's happening in the late 1880s where he wasn't doing anything. He just had his sons and his relatives were back there switching the sieves and the pipes where they already had the pure sugar. They would just take the dirty sugar and just kind of move it out of the way and put the pure sugar in place and then tell them, look, we made this high-grade sugar for you, and take their money and run. I think it's insane.
But wait, what was the end game? Because it seems like that con only works up as long as you are – like it seems like the exchange is I am getting a bunch of dirty sugar – and I'm giving you back a bunch of actual sugar. Unlike those blood tests, which are like impossible. Like, what was it? Like the blood tests, like you could do them, but you couldn't do them as fast, right? So it was like possible to do it. What's the long game in this one? Because it seems like it's a profit losing endeavor. Like I could run that company right now. I could be like, you guys bring me some rocks. And I'm going to come back with some gold. But eventually, like I'd run out of money because I'd have to be giving you gold.
Yeah, this is, we'll have to speculate. Like it goes beyond my understanding. I was like, I don't know. Like, I don't know if the end game was just like they're always going to stay one step ahead of the investors, and so then the next town they won't know them. And here I am speculating. There's another sugar historian, a friend of mine, David Singerman, who knows more about this particular story, and especially its connections to like English investors and people all over Liverpool and London who are putting money into it. So you got a lot of foreign investors in it as well to try to build the system. But it's possible that maybe he told them that once you do the refining, there's less there. Like maybe it takes away something. So what if you get like a dirty batch, maybe the pure batch is always smaller.
So he was trying to con investors then.
Yeah.
It sounds crazy to us, but like this is not that far off the era where like, I mean, you know, in the early 19th century, manufacturing, like machines are state secrets. You know, so I guess it's like with there's that without like the insurance that your invention will be protected. You just said someone stole the, you know, the patent of margarine. So I guess in that sense, you're like, well, of course they won't let us see it. But, you know.
Yeah, it's a, you know, kind of famously lightly regulated time period that I think allows a lot of these kind of scams. People were so surprised or frustrated by it. They actually wrote to Edison's labs to ask him, is like, can you really do this? And Edison's offices answered like, no, we don't. We've never heard of that. We don't have anything to do with it. I don't think that's true. But they were like just in disbelief. Even when this guy, he died, he was an alcoholic and he died. And then 9 months later, it wasn't until 9 months after he died where they finally caught up with the system, because his wife, who was this younger woman, like had to leave town and went back to Michigan. And they have all these news stories about the police cutting this ever tightening dragnet to catch the electric sugar con. And then even after he died, like Harper's Weekly is writing, like they don't believe it. They think it's fake. They're like, he didn't really die. He's just saying that. Like, so it was a multi-level scam. He really did die apparently, but people didn't even believe that.
It was so much easier to disappear back then. Anyway, moving on.
Yeah. Well, it's like Harof, who tried to disappear to South America. They still caught up with him.
That's right. So, you know, what's interesting about this, Ben, there's a spatial history aspect to this because it's this ever widening distance between people. When we talked about it earlier a little bit about where you live and what you eat, and that distance grows further and further and further as we move through the 19th century. And you kind of mentioned it telling the story about the glucose scam, the sugar scam, when you said, you know, the corn is coming in to Chicago. And then that's where all this stuff, like, it's just like, I think about meat packing and how the cattle begin to travel greater and greater distances. And it comes to a centralized location, Chicago, and then it goes from there. Talk about this period in American history that kind of goes along with all this, where that we say farm to table now. That's a very popular thing to say, farm to table. But that, it was just the opposite happening.
Yeah, I mean, it's a key anchor for this. And I was lucky to kind of work on the backs of so many historians who talked about that kind of growth of those, like the meatpacking industry as a central one. So I can mention even on that point, the reason we have margarine is because of the meatpackers. Margarine was made originally it was using less milk than usual, than butter, and then more cow fat. They just used the fat of the cow, and they blended that in with the milk. They thought they were clever in the patents. They're like, listen, this is natural. Like, the cow is going to express the milk anyways. We're just shortcutting it by going inside the cow and taking its fat out and then, you know, blending it in with the milk and making this thing margarine. I don't know what you're all upset about. It's all the same thing. But it's the meat packers who are doing that. It's Armour and Swift, you know, two of the big ones. They have like the big five or the big six. And their ability to do this is because they've managed to build this centralized system of, you know, in the decades before you develop a, you know, the cows aren't migrating. You're not moving them like old images of cowboys. Let's go from north to south and kind of do these cow drives from whatever, Minnesota to Texas. It's more like we've got these in Omaha and Kansas City, which are now connected to the rails, and they're all getting sent into Chicago to be processed. And so you start to build this network. And in large part, what I'm here is I'm just like cribbing William Cronin's Nature's Metropolis. He talks a lot about this.
Yeah, I've read some of that in my urban history class. Yeah.
So you get the even bigger story there. But these kind of spin into global networks. The other big case, we talked about glucose, which is fake sugar. We talked about margarine, which is fake butter. And the third one was cottonseed oil, which they used as fake lard or fake olive oil. And so lard, which I didn't even know was really a thing. Like, I grew up in a Jewish household. I didn't know people ate lard. I thought it was a synonym for something that you don't want to eat. Like, I didn't really grasp it. So I was like, why does anybody care about pure lard? Like, it just kind of blew my mind because I was ignorant. But that was a huge staple of all diets. And it, too, had this relationship with growing centralized meatpacking where, you know, all the hog farms, which had been in Cincinnati, but, you know, moved to Chicago, lead to this aggregation of all these supplies. So they think they're clever. They're like, we're going to make some byproducts, which seems smart as business people. We shouldn't be wasting all this extra stuff. We should use all the fat. It's not just the meat. We'll make fake lard. But well, they're mad at fake lard, but we'll make fake butter with our margarine. The fake lard is a problem for the meat packers because now people are mixing cottonseed oil from the South, where you actually take cottonseeds and crush them, and you can extract oil from cottonseeds, and it mixes pretty well with to create something like lard, and it's used the same way. So now you got this combat between the Southern states and the cotton growers and the meat packers in the Midwest. So if you're arguing like about policy and like, is it bad? Is it good? You know, the cottonseed oil people are saying there's nothing wrong with it. It's just a better product. But the meatpackers are getting mad and they're saying, you're screwing us over. Like, you need to come up with this regulation to keep away all this fake lard. And then they're like, is it bad because it's fake? Like, we thought artificial meant bad, but now, I don't know, maybe artificial is progress. Maybe that's a better thing for us.
Right. So this is kind of the point here. The idea that you have the con of margarine, the con of corn syrup, but this becomes acceptable, right? This all becomes acceptable. How does it become acceptable?
Man, that's too hard of a question.
You wrote the book.
I know.
Yeah, man. You know what? If you didn't want to ask that, answer this question, maybe you shouldn't have written this book, okay?
Well, part of what we talked about before, part of what becomes acceptable is that you build a new marketing enterprise. There's a new industry to help sell and market these things. So that's one aspect. Part of it is that, you know, you have a growing population, you have a growing immigrant population, you have a growing urban population, and you're generating a need to produce more food. And these artificial byproduct things are can come across as a solution to that. Just as today we talk about, you know, we need to feed the world. We need to grow more food. Population is increasing. How are we going to feed the world? They might not have used that phrase, feed the world, then, but it was the same kind of mentality of we're able to supply food to growing populations with our new techniques. It's also, you know, the kind of the full blossoming of the Industrial Revolution where people are saying this is what the future is. Like, we don't have to hold an agrarian life. We're going to live a life based on the products of factories. And so there's an increasing sensibility that artificial things are good in a way that you couldn't have argued or they didn't argue, say, you know, the mid-19th century. But by the time you get to the beginning of the 20th century, it seems like, well, this is the future. Like, industry And this technological processing, this is progress. So you've got like these huge structural reasons, like the growth of industrialization. You've got things like marketing industry being invented. And, you know, you got capitalism. It's going to be hard to talk about it without capitalism.
Yeah, you know, Ben Sawyer and Ben Cohen, this reminds me so much of Bart Elmore, Citizen Coke.
Yeah.
You know, and this...
Oh, was Bart on? I know Bart.
Yeah, we have we like to have all you business. What are you? Is this to me? This is part urban history, part business history. What is this? What do you call this?
For me, I call it the history of science, technology, and food. I come at it as an environmental historian, which Bart does environmental history. He was a grad student at UVA when I was teaching there, and we talked about that project. He helped me early on talking about this.
So you must also know Calvin Schermerhorn.
I know the name, but I don't know him personally.
He was at UVA too.
Yeah. But I think I've been hesitant to call myself a business historian because I don't, I haven't published or been at business history conferences, but yeah, it touches on all that. I think of it like your earlier question about the increasing networks and the kind of pulling together centralized meatpacking and shipping them to the East Coast or gathering all that corn and processing it into corn syrup. To me, those are interesting as environmental stories of how much material it takes, how much work we have to do to change the landscape, to build these refineries. For glucose, like it was an enormous amount of water. It was an enormous amount of things like sulfuric acid. You had to have like chemical makers. The glucose makers, they would get in trouble because they would be incorporated in urban places like New York or Chicago, but the factories would be out in like Iowa and Indiana, which were even more lightly regulated. They'd be on rivers because they sucked up so much water. And it was interesting to me to like just see how much does it take to make all these new foods, which people at the time, part of the time, they're saying, this really bothers us. We don't like that they're faking part of the time. And as eventually happens, they're saying, this is the wave of the future. Like we're coming up with solutions. This is very innovative. And I think like it's on the backs of a lot of environmental changes that we try to still ignore in terms of our food system. Like this is the birth of industrial food.
It's fascinating to me. Like it's always that double-edged sword with this era and with capitalism and with our modern system where it's like, on the one hand, you're like, this progress is amazing. But then when you don't have methods for actually like tabulating the cost, not just the price, but the cost, then you kind of have these amorphous categories of like, you know, basically cost you're paying that never get brought up. And if you don't actually have a way to measure these things in a way that like is meaningful, then it all looks like it's a wimp.
Yeah. And so that's in part why Upton Sinclair will get so much credit because he's like, hey, this isn't such progress. This is terrible for workers. Like this isn't, it's not just about food. Like he wrote The Jungle because he was concerned about workers' rights. Like he was a socialist who was mad about labor practices and he used the meatpacking industry to show how bad labor practices were. Although most people read it as about how bad the food was. But they're trying to point out like this question of progress is not so obvious. Like there's a lot of people getting hurt and the robber barons, the capitalists, they're the ones who are benefiting. So that's just more reason to not trust them.
Yeah, and you have that turn in the progressive era. And so far, we've been talking about adulteration in terms of using things that are supposedly natural and replacing them with something that's like in between or questionable. But there was a greater trend within food production that was not putting something else in that was actually food, but actually putting things that are unquestionably not food, things like sawdust and sausage and all of that. How common was that?
It's difficult to know for sure if it was overstated because you do have like the muckraking press trying to generate concern for these things, but it wasn't trivial. So there's longstanding issues of adulteration that precede this era, but also carry through it. Things like sawdust in sugar or water in milk. Bob, you were asking, we were saying before about the distance, the increasing distance from the consumer and the producer, which is such a big feature of this era, this spreading out from city to country. And that's one reason, like you don't know where your food's coming from anymore. But it wasn't new that people would try to trick you or water down the milk. It's just that it happened within the confines of your own community. So when you were policing it, you had a certain understanding of like who was doing this and why you wouldn't do it. But it wasn't because it didn't happen. It was just smaller scale. So when you get like these sand and sugar, sawdust and flour, I think I said misspoke earlier, sand and sugar, sawdust and flour, water and milk, those have been going on for centuries. I have a, there's a line in there about somebody who adulterated saffron. I think it was in the 1300s. And like they were burned at the stake. Like you don't do that stuff. Think of the pure beer laws of what's supposed to go in beer. That goes back, you know, centuries.
What's that? Like every German beer is like brewed in accordance with the German purity law of like, was it 1512?
I'm forgetting the exact year, but see, it's something, you know, that long ago. It wasn't a trivial point when people pointed out, is this just another thing that we've already been trying to fight against? Is margarine just full of chemicals that are going to kill us? Is this the new modern version of water in your milk? I got a lot of cartoons in the book because I love this magazine, Puck, which was the Onion of its day.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah, I really kind of overplay it because I just loved it so much. There's so much great material. And they were so good at trying to stand up for the little man, for the immigrant, for the working class by poking fun at supposed, you know, capitalists or robber barons and just kind of mocking them and parodying what these new things were. So you see a lot of cartoons about the, you know, the sawdust and flour or the sugar or the sand and the sugar or the you know, water and the milk to point out that, you know, country folk aren't rubes. Like they're smart. They know when the city folk are trying to screw them over, but also the opposite. City folk aren't rubes. They know when the country farmer who just kind of ambles into town and plays it up like, hey, check out my fresh country milk. Like, you know, it goes both ways. It wasn't just one dynamic, but because they were getting an exaggerated separation, it just is all exacerbated.
So where are we now with this? We're in this era of whole foods and paleo foods and keto foods, and we're looking for purity in our food and what we put in our bodies. We're very conscious, at least culturally, we're conscious of it. When I look at all these organic, you know, so-called organic foods or, you know, foods that advertise themselves as being healthy, I have to wonder, are they really healthy? Where are we with this?
Yeah, so I find that it gets more complicated over time, not less complicated. So there's one way to tell the story, which is, and then finally, on the 191st time, they passed the law and all was great and good. And food was never contaminated anymore. And that's not really the conclusion. I think we resolved a lot of the problems from the 1800s, and the Pure Food Law deserves an enormous amount of credit, and not the least of which is the founding of a new regulatory system called the FDA. But we keep coming up with new inventions and new ways to think about what we should eat, and it keeps demanding the same questions of, how do I know if it's healthy or not? So even the way you phrased it, Bob, is the one that fascinates me the most is, you know, I don't know the answer to everything of if it's healthy or not healthy, but when you intertwine those histories of science, technology, and the environment, you start to ask, or at least I started to ask a lot about the how do you know question. Like what changes historically? Like what? Who tells us? Who do we trust? Do we count on the expert? Like you said at the beginning, where we built expertise in the early 20th century to solve these problems. Now we question experts all the time, and that makes it more difficult to know if our food is healthy. Like, we're certainly not going to, I hope, trust Gwyneth Paltrow. Like, what's the goop going to do for
us?
Let's
not.
And genetically modified foods.
Yeah. Isn't that the big one?
That is the big one.
I held off as long as I could until, like, the epilogue to really, you know, kind of make a point or think through that. And in the context of this book, or like as a result of doing this research, at the end of the eighth chapter, which is right before the epilogue, where the book goes to is to find out that in the mid-19th century, or at least up to the mid-19th century, pure and natural were kind of combined. They lived in the same world. So they weren't necessarily directly synonymous, but they kind of hung out together. And you knew that something was pure or natural because you knew where it came from. Like you understood its provenance. again, that didn't mean it was never corrupted. It just meant that the way that you figured that out was through, you know, knowing the people. By the early 20th century, that's what changes is that, first of all, pure and natural aren't necessarily combined anymore. You can have something purely artificial as long as the scientific label says this is exactly what it claims to be. Today, we like it's pure cubic zirconia. I remember these ads from my childhood. Like,
oh, no.
Like, I can see these like late night ads like pure cubic zirconia. It's like it's purely a fake thing, which is a product of us being so industrialized that we have so many artificial things that those concepts aren't held together anymore. They had a brand. There was Purity brand margarine in the early 1900s.
Doublespeak.
This is purely fake. So what happens across that time is that we start to understand purity as a scientific concept. Purity used to be part of like lived experience. Like it follows certain agricultural practices. It's part of our environmental living. It's part of our community standards. And that kind of gets moved out by the early 1900s to say, now science is or purity is a scientific concept. We'll trust the analysts to tell us if what's in the product is what the maker claims is in the product. And that in part is a consequence of us becoming consumers. Like, few and fewer people are farmers as the years go by, so fewer and fewer of us have access to understand how the food is made. We have to rely on that certification, and it comes at the very end of the process. To me, that's what plays out so much over the next century, because of course things change quite a lot in 100 years since then. But we're dealing today with these kind of questions like, what do I do with GMOs? How do I know if that's okay or not? How do I know which diet is a healthy one? How do I know if somebody's trying to scam me? And we can only ask these questions now as consumers. So we answer the question by trying to get better scientific analysis or more trusted equipment or more studies and more experiments, as opposed to trying to figure it out by learning more about our food system from growing food or being part of an agricultural system or working with farmers. We're not going to go back. Like, we're not going to all become farmers again. It doesn't make any sense. But we could be doing a lot more to understand the environmental context of our food, like all these environmental practices that make the food. That could be a way to think about purity. And I think that's why there's so much controversy about genetic modification. I don't know of evidence, I say this at the end, I don't know your experience, I don't know of evidence that GMOs make us sick, but there's a lot of evidence that GMOs confuse us, and that there are strong environmental implications of shifting to more monocropped, genetically modified fields. So we can't really get anywhere. I don't think we'll make progress in the future if we leave this just or only to a label, because we don't have to learn anything more about our food system. We're trusting someone else to tell us that.
It is amazing that we spend so much time talking about what a food will do to us, what food is the healthiest, and so little time thinking about the impact of that food being produced on the places we live, when we're not sure, for example, like which foods, right? There's debate about it. We're learning more and more, but it's unquestionable that dumping all these fertilizers into the water, dealing with all of this just like concentrated, like animal waste, like there's no question that that is bad for us. And I never really thought about it in those terms that you just said that.
Yeah, and I don't want to overplay this analogy, but we're talking about what was Professor Henry Friend's endgame? Like, what did he hope to get? Or was he just always trying to stay one step ahead? I think of that with a lot of these like high industrial, extremely technological genetic modifications. Like, what's the endgame? Are we just trying to stay, like, we know that there's problems, but we're going to try to stay one step ahead, or we'll come up with the next solution, a technical fix for the fertilizer, and we'll stay one step ahead and try to come up with a technical fix for the pesticide because we're causing new problems by growing the food this way. And I don't know where it ends.
So like Bathsheba DeMuth said in her book and then in the conversation we had, that in some ways capitalism in its modern form is the denial of death.
What a great phrase.
It's just always moving forward, always saying there is a next step and never wondering what will happen, because if you're always thinking about the next step, you never have to acknowledge that there is an end.
Right. That's very well put. And I think because we live with these questions as they happen, it's like there's historical material to understand how we got here, but we also deal with it every day. And you see that there are advantages to some things. It's not like, I think we're always going to be genetically modifying something. So it's more about like, what are the limits of that, or how much is too much, or how far is too far? I use a phrase, one of the chapters is called Analysis as Border Patrol, where I understood analysis is really, they're the ones who define the line between pure and adulterated. It's not like that's just some universal objective thing. Like, we got to decide, people have to make the determination. And it's really like patrolling that border. That's the historically changing thing. We have some kind of say in that. So with like genetic modification, people who are concerned about it think that it's a step too far, like you've crossed the line. And people who are less concerned about it say, no, maybe we're pushing the line, but this is how history goes. So it's this battle between these border patrollers. Wow.
One of the stories that I tell in my class, I just wanted to get your feedback on it. Because right now I'm teaching U.S. history too. So we're just going into the 1890s and talk about the push for the for regulation under Roosevelt. And it goes to this fantastic story that I think demonstrates it really well. A couple of years ago, there was a woman who got in trouble for trying to cross the border between Canada and the U.S. with Kinder Surprise, the original ones. For those of you guys who don't know, like, you can get the Kinder Surprise, the chocolate eggs from Germany here, and you break them apart, and one side is the chocolate and the other side is the little toy. But everywhere else in the world, it's a chocolate egg. The whole thing's chocolate, right? And you pop it open, and inside there's a little yellow, like, capsule. It's pretty big, like, relatively. And, you know, inside that's the toy. And people, like, this woman got in trouble for it because it was against the law to bring those or sell those in the United States. And a lot of people were kind of dismissing this, saying, this is ridiculous. That yellow thing, it's probably the size of, like, I don't know what I say. It's like you could fit it in your mouth, but there's no way you could swallow it unless you were going to die. But people were saying, this is ridiculous. You know, it's a choking hazard. This is stupid. But then people pointed out, it's actually not a choking hazard. It is a violation of the FDA to bring it in, because when it was originally passed to get around all of the things that were being put into different foods, the law had a blanket statement that was, no non-food product shall be encased fully in a food product. Therefore, by having the chocolate egg on the outside, it was all chocolate that you saw. The plastic was on the inside, so it was a violation of that law, which I think tells you a lot about like how like much of a blanket statement you had to make to stop all of the things they were putting into foods, to basically make sure they weren't selling people, you know, sawdust and things like that.
Yeah, smugglers.
Yeah. Had you ever heard that story before? It's like, me and my wife loved it because we never knew why we couldn't get those. We ate them all the time in Russia.
No, I hadn't heard that story. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Do you know how, like, so what was the ultimate resolution? Did she?
No, they put her to death. They hang up. I'm sorry.
Burned at the stake.
Honestly, I'm not sure what the outcome was. I doubt it was that. But overall, it was just that. I remember it being like, you know how it's like they'll say like, oh, the person spilled coffee on themselves and then sued McDonald's. Ah, and then you go and look into it and you're like, well, actually, it's not that simple.
Right, right.
You know, it was one of those stories where I thought it was like there was the outcry about how stupid it was that it was a choking hazard. And then everyone said, and then I can't remember who it was came in and said, no, it's not a choking hazard. It's a violation of the FDA. And that, I think, really tells you something about how bad it was when they passed the regulations.
Yeah, those the border crossing, the kind of the national border lines or different policies, when they clash, you learn so much in the exact way that you said it. Like, it might seem simplistic, but then when you open up the story, like you open up the egg, it reveals this whole more complicated tale of like, well, how did this get here? And what's the explanation for why we even care about this? You know, you have one thing that binds together those borders and the food regulation questions is one of the parts in the margarine chapter. Is something which it seems like simple, like the dairy lobby was against margarine, which would seem to make sense because it's cutting into their butter profits. And so we get the story of like, oh, like city folk, they don't care. They like the margarine because it's cheaper and you can get more of it. So why is that bad? It's just the dairy people, the farmers are against it. They're obstinate and resistant. Then you say, well, you know, I can understand it's a power struggle and we get it. The dairy lobby is losing power over the years and they're trying to hold on to this. But it does. So that's the thing that actually is so much more complicated to me in an environmentally interesting way, because we used to have a much more thoroughly environmentally healthy agricultural system where the reason we have cows was to fertilize the fields so that you could grow the grass, so that you could grow stronger crops. And you would get butter as one of these byproducts because the best butter came from the best grass and the best cows. So if you're talking about butter, you're talking about cows. And if you're talking about cows, you're talking about grass and wheat fields. So as we're moving westward across the continent, we're opening up more and more fields and growing more and more food, and you're bringing cows with you to fertilize those fields. Now, they're getting mad in the late 1800s because the Canadians are doing a really good job, especially there's, you know, this comment about the lakes of Manitoba because they have such fertile grass. There's such, you know, these naturally fed farmlands. And so there's like trade agreements and disputes of like global trade of butter. And, you know, the British, you know, it's British syndicates that own Canada. They're doing all this. And so this gets to the point where when dairy lobbyists are arguing in Washington about protecting their butter, it's not just about the dairy lobby. It's about allowing for the entire expansion of the nation and fighting all these global forces that are going to outsell them on the open market. And if you let in margarine, then you're not going to be able to sell your butter, which means you can't get the benefit of the cows, which means you're not going to be able to grow the wheat fields, which means you're not going to be able to feed people. And so like they even get where Congress is paying attention to like the Suez Canal opens up. I don't know if this comes in your class. I forget what year it is. But they're paying attention to British imports in and out of the Suez Canal from South Asia because they know that when the British are down, they'll be able to strike and sell more. And so they're trying to do these agreements in Washington about tariffs and regulations on barter trade or wheat trade. And they got to pay attention to things like riots in India that are going to impinge on traffic through the Suez Canal, which is going to influence the amount of wheat trade across the world. And all of a sudden, all that has to do with margarine. So you could just say, like, sure, the dairy lobby was mad and they just didn't want to lose power. But if you pull back and really crack it open, you're saying, this is transforming the entire possibility of westward expansion and the full dominance of the nation.
Yeah, and the Suez Canal opened in 1869. And so this is like how early they're thinking about it. But this is also a time as the country is trying to, as Heather Cox Richardson has pointed out in West of Appomattox, this is the moment where the North and South find common cause in moving west.
Yeah. I find it fascinating. One of the things that I found fascinating is how entangled all these policy and market and agricultural and global trade systems are. That's very hard to hold them apart because they're so integrated with one another. And that making easy answers of, well, they just didn't want to lose a buck. It's not a really satisfying answer to why you'd be opposed to a so-called adulterated product or why you'd fight so much against it.
Yeah. It's like today when you're like, hey, I don't think it's cool to like ask a foreign leader to do you a favor to investigate a political opponent. I think like that's objectively a pretty unquestionable thing. And people are like, of course you think that, you're a Democrat. And I'm like, I'm not. And they're like, well, you would be, I don't know what's going on. So it's like, that's the catch-all, right? Of course you're just biased. You're interested in this. And then we fail to like take into account all of the implications, right? But the simple fact that like you have an interest in it. Yes, we should be skeptical of you every time, but to write someone off like that, write a whole position off because there is someone who has an interest in it. Like, tell me something that happens that someone doesn't have an interest in, you know?
Ben, this has been a great conversation and the book is incredible. Pure Adulteration, Cheating on Nature in the Age of Manufactured Food. It's a really enjoyable, fascinating, and it's hard to put it down.
Thank you so much. On sale now.
Yes, on sale everywhere. And when you write your next book about GMO, you come on and talk about it.
All right.
That's right. That's like, I don't know if you read the terms we sent you, but like our new thing now is like, we bring someone on to talk about your most recent work and then we tell you what book we want you to write next. Right. So this is going to be great, man. We got a lot of questions and like this podcast is taking time. So, you know, go write the book. We'll have you back in like a year.
Is that what I was really clicking on the Zoom?
That's right. That's it. That's it.
Read the fine print.
You have 6 months to send us a first draft. Thank you.
I'll do the best I can, sir. Sorry, sir.
But thanks again.
Awesome. Thanks, y'all. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Road to Now. The Road to Now is hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. This episode was edited by Gary Fletcher. Our social media manager is Austin Sawyer, and today's music is by Paul DeFiglia. If you have not gone and rated us on iTunes, please do so. We need you to do that so we can spread the word about this podcast. Everyone who has, we say thank you. Speaking of thanks, we'd like to say a special thanks to everyone on Patreon who helps make this podcast possible, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians: Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Fig White, Jeff LeCain, Peggy Donica, Susan Sharp, Joseph Mann, Matt Williams, and Mariah Wolford. If you'd like to join our community of patrons and get lots of extra content, just go to patreon.com/theroadtonow and pick a tier. For as little as $5 a month, you get access to episodes 1 through 75, some extras, bonus content, and it only gets better from there. For Bob Crawford, this is Ben Sawyer. Thanks for listening, and take care.